Welcome to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is an etude by Frédéric Chopin, performed by pianist Murray Pariah. The word etude is from the French word for study. Many pieces in the classical repertoire have this title. Often, etudes are not just drills or exercises to be repeated in the privacy of a practice room to prepare the performer for real repertoire. These exercises were written in such a way that they were to be consumed by a concert audience as well. These impressive pieces are part of the standard repertoire. In fact, much of the music performed today was written for the express purpose of educating the music student. In one sense, it would refine their skills, but the music itself would also stand alone as a performable work of art. And in this episode, we will explore compositions that were intended to serve as a teaching tool. In our segment, Sounds of Scripture, we will discuss the Bible's many musical compositions written to teach both performer and listener. In our segment, Backstage Banter, I talk with pianist, educator, and writer Mark Jenkins about why music students, pianists especially, have to play Bach in order to become better musicians.
Because the two hands are doing different things, you have to learn to cut that invisible ribbon between them. That's a skill that transfers over to everything else that you play.
And in our Classroom Corner segment, we will hear an essay from a student about what her music lessons have taught her about life.
These are four piano keys to life that I've learned. There are many more keys, probably even over 88. But hopefully these few will be a good start to playing life more beautifully.
Today on Music for Life, Music for Education. On this program, we explore the great music of history. And today we are exploring music that was written for educational purposes. Now, I'm not talking about music as a mnemonic device for teaching other non-musical concepts. We are all familiar with that concept, whether it's memorizing the letters of the alphabet to a Mozartian tune, or involuntarily remembering the slogan of that product through the incessant repetition of a commercial jingle. But I'm talking about music written for the musical or technical development of the performer. When a composer writes a piece of music, you may think that he or she is doing it because they have a burning desire to compose music that will later be shared in a performance. Or maybe you think of a composer writing a piece of music because a fellow performer or ensemble commissions that composer to write something for an upcoming engagement. And both of those scenarios are true, and they are reasons why composers write music. Music is also written sometimes to fill a need at a specific occasion. But did you know that a lot of the music we hear performed today was written to educate music students? The great music teachers of history, who were also composers, created these pieces to develop the budding musicians, or even to refine professional performers, and they remain as some of the great repertoire still programmed today. Before we get into specific examples from standard music history, I want to show how this idea of music for education goes back into biblical times. So let's move into our first segment today, Sounds of Scripture, where we survey the Bible's many references to music for a longer-sweeping historical perspective on our episode's theme. The inscription of Psalm 60 says this particular composition is to teach. The inscription reads, in the King James Version, "To the chief musician upon Shushaneduth, Michtam of David, to teach when he strove with Aram-naharaim and with Aram-zobah, when Joab returned and smote of Edom in the Valley of Salt 12,000. Alfred Sendri, in his book Music in Ancient Israel, supposes the phrase to teach means to teach the young. Now that brings up the question, why would only one psalm of the 150 chapters in the Book of Psalms be specified that way, when several other psalms specifically mention the idea of teaching children within the lyrics of the psalms? The Targum compares Moses' last composition, Deuteronomy 32, to Psalm 60. Deuteronomy 32 is a song Moses wrote just before he died, teaching the nation why curses would come if they disobeyed God's laws. The Hebrew for teach in this psalm can mean to be trained for war, which makes sense with the rest of Psalm 60's inscription and with the content of the psalm having to do with God's triumphs in war. The psalms are replete with the Hebrew word for teach. 12 chapters of the book of Psalms use this particular Hebrew word that was found in the inscription of Psalm 60 in their lyrics. Of the 150 chapters in the book of Psalms, though, 13 of them are noted with a unique Hebrew word. Now, 59 of these chapters are noted as psalms in the inscriptions, 5 of them are identified as prayers, 30 are called songs, but 13 of them are noted as maskil, an obscure Hebrew word that the King James Version translators didn't even bother to translate. They just leave it in Hebrew. The inscription for Psalm 32, for instance, reads, "Of David, maskil." This Hebrew word maskil has an uncertain meaning, but it comes from the root sakal, meaning to be prudent, circumspect, to have insight, comprehension. This root is translated elsewhere in the Bible as wisdom or understanding. So this has prompted some translations or margin references to render it a psalm for understanding or a psalm for instruction. This root word is even used in the body or lyrics of Psalm 32. It says, "I will instruct you and teach you in the way which you shall go. I will guide you with mine eye." So the word instruct is the Hebrew sakal. Now perhaps maskil is referring to some sort of educational psalm, some educational song, or a song to give instruction, maybe a song of wisdom, as some have rendered it. Psalm 78 is inscribed as a maskil of Asaph. Asaph was one of those chief musicians of King David. A maskil of Asaph, which might mean for Asaph to give instruction. The body of Psalm 78 has to do with instructing the next generation about one's spiritual history. The obvious question, though, is why only 13 of these psalms are inscribed this way? Did the biblical writers not consider all the psalms valuable for instruction? Or why does not each one make a specific reference to instructing, as Psalm 32 and Psalm 78 do, in the lyrics themselves? Perhaps the clue is in their metrical similarities, as Alfred Sendri wrote in his book. But even with this, he noted that this metrical similarity is found in other psalms that are not inscribed as maskil. So it's an interesting Hebrew word to look at, and one to consider in light of music for education. These pieces obviously possessed some unique characteristic that would qualify them to be listed as a certain type of composition, one that uses a Hebrew word that has a root word implying wisdom or instruction or education. Sendri wonders if they were only for those in the nation who actually had the endowment of God's Holy Spirit, which was not made available to the nation at large. Or perhaps it has a musical connotation. Perhaps these were only to be performed by those who were skilled, or like our etudes today, that they had some musically educational value for the one learning it. Again, like those etudes and studies that our music students learn today. The Bible uses the words skillful or cunning to describe certain musicians. The Hebrew meanings for those words skillful and cunning can mean to know or discern or to be learned or to be educated. So perhaps some of the compositions, as the Psalms indicate, were intended to be performed by those who were skilled in this trade. Now, it's clear that the Bible endorses music education, or being skilled in a musical instrument. The educational institutions that Samuel founded clearly taught various families and varieties of musical instruments, and had those students perform publicly, as was the case for the future King Saul, as found in 1 Samuel 10. And of course, the Bible teaches that music can be an educational tool for teaching non-musical spiritual concepts. Colossians 3:16 reads, "Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord." Another major purpose for music is to help Scripture dwell in you richly in all wisdom, and it mentions that music can be used in teaching and admonishing one another. This has been Sounds of Scripture.
Show me thy ways, O Lord.
are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. So much of the repertoire we hear performed on the concert stage today was not exclusively intended for performance as much as for the purpose of training music students. Such was the case of many of the great keyboard works by Johann Sebastian Bach. Johann Nikolaus Forkel's 1802 biography of Bach discusses Bach as a teacher. Quote, "Only he who knows much is able to teach much. Only he who has become acquainted with the dangers firsthand and has surmounted them is able to expose them in teaching his disciples successfully." Bach was undoubtedly in possession of both virtues, and consequently his teaching offered an instructive, useful, and secure foundation, and all of his pupils, at least in one branch of the art, followed the great master, although none of them was able to excel or even reach him. Unquote. Describing Bach's keyboard teaching, Forkel writes, "For this purpose, the pupils had to practice finger exercises aimed at achieving a distinct and clean touch." So Bach composed small pieces which incorporated the kinds of finger exercises he required. In this category of compositions are the 6 short preludes for beginners and the 2-part inventions, a type of keyboard work that requires significant independence of the hands. Each hand is doing its own part, independent of the other. He also wrote suites and other larger instrumental works for his students. Here's an example of a 2-part invention. This is basically a kind of canon or round for the pianist, where each hand plays similar material, but at different times, requiring, again, a great deal of coordination and independence of hands. Here's the invention number 8 in F major, performed by pianist András Schiff. So that was András Schiff performing Bach's Invention No. 8 in F major. And this is an example of a famous work written by the composer as a teaching tool for his music students. Bach's works in particular have great educational and pedagogical value for musicians in training. And to talk more about that, let's move into our segment Backstage Banter, where we interview performers on the concert circuit today for their perspectives on music. This is a future concert performer. His name is Spencer, and he's 9 years old. That's him practicing one of these 2-part inventions by Bach. Learning the works of Johann Sebastian Bach has become vital to the development of any musician and performer. This goes all the way back to the time just after Bach. In his book, Music of the Spheres, Jamie James discusses 2 of Bach's students, Johann Christian Kittel and Johann Philipp Kernberger. He says, "Each of them had an oil painting of the master hanging over his piano to serve as a kind of reward or punishment for his students. If they played well, they were permitted to gaze upon the image of Bach. But when they played badly, the teacher would lower a curtain over it." Well, there is immense value in a musician learning Bach, and this is especially true for pianists. But what is it about Bach's works that make this so? To talk about that today, I sit down with pianist, arranger, educator, and writer Mark Jenkins. He performs frequently at Armstrong Auditorium, teaches on the Herbert W. Armstrong College music faculty, and also manages and writes for the Philadelphia Church of God's Youth magazine. Last year, he gave a lecture to our music students on why we learn Bach. So I've invited him to talk with us about that exact subject today. Thanks for coming on the program, Mark.
Good to be here.
So let's get right into it. Why do you make Bach such a huge part of your curriculum, and why is it important to learn Bach's music?
Well, just to give a little bit of background, when we were in high school, we had the same piano teacher. You, of course, remember that.
Yeah, I haven't mentioned that to the listeners. You and I both come from the same studio there in St. Louis.
Well, we studied with a pianist named Jane Allen, and there was a predictable breakdown to how our music lessons went. We always had about five pieces at a time. We would start our lessons with scales, arpeggios, some sort of technical exercise. You could rely on working on a piece of music in certain categories. One of them would be Baroque, one would be some sort of classical sonata, one would be romantic, and the other two perhaps weren't as easy to pigeonhole, but those first three categories were going to be covered. When we were younger, you could guarantee that that Baroque piece was going to be by Bach. You knew the classical sonata would probably be by Beethoven. The romantic piece would probably be by Chopin. I mean, if Miss Allen were here today and we were talking to her about this, I think that she would say the most important part of that breakdown between the technical exercises, the Bach, the Chopin, the Beethoven, would be practicing the works of Johann Sebastian Bach. That there are a lot of reasons that this is the best study method for learning to play the piano. I break it down into five basic categories that she was teaching using Bach. The first of those is establishing rhythmic principles. There are two sides to that. The first piece of music that she ever gave me was a Bach invention. I think it was the F major invention. And there are two things we would do. One, we would turn on a metronome. Two, we would count out loud. These two things are not replacements for each other. You need to do both. But she established those rhythmic principles primarily with Bach. That's the first place that we would do that. So you get that sense of pulse, that sense of timing, right off the bat with your easiest Bach pieces. Second thing, and this is especially good in Bach, is learning to actually find melodies. The melodies aren't just put on the top the way they are in most Chopin pieces, for instance, where you have a chordal structure underneath and then a melody sitting on the top. Things are frequently contrapuntal. If you have a more complex piece of Bach, you might have a five-voice fugue and have to locate where the subject is all the way through the piece.
So you're talking about the melody being not just in the right hand, essentially, but it's going through both hands, and it's even different parts of the hands.
Well, and I suppose you could compare it to a choir, that if you had a soprano, an alto, a tenor, and a bass, the melody might be moving between those four parts.
Right.
Essentially, you feel the same thing as a pianist, and you have to move the melody throughout the piece as you go to where it belongs.
And that's very complex for 10 fingers, 2 hands.
Well, and the thing is, you do that in Chopin, you do that in Beethoven, but if you don't do that in Chopin or Beethoven, it doesn't have the same penalty. You don't have the same problem with it. If you don't do that in Bach, it's instantly obvious that you're bringing out a counter melody on the top and ignoring the actual melody.
Right.
So Bach teaches you to take an analytical eye to it as you're learning.
And an ear, I guess you could say.
And there's a sense of progression. This is true for all of these points, but I mean, I started with that F major invention, which only had two voices. I did probably 5 or 6 inventions. Then I did a 3-part sinfonia. So now I have 3 parts that I'm looking through to find the melodies. Then you move on to the well-tempered clavier. Maybe you do a 4-part fugue, and now you're picking between 4 parts, figuring out how to bring things out, how to make them work. Then you go on to a 5-part fugue, and now you have to really find ways to bring the melody out correctly all the way through the piece. And the way Bach has set that up, you really can progress from a beginner to an advanced student and maintain that sense of analysis the same way you did at the beginning, but with more complexity.
Right, starting small, just 2 voices at the same time that are working independently of each other, but working well together, and then, like you said, moving up into 4-5-part fugues.
Right. Third thing is learning to hear separate parts. One of the first things I'll usually ask a beginning student to do is to take a piece of Bach and sing a melody for me, and I'll just make sure they can do that. And then I'll say, okay, now I'd like you to hear that in your mind. Hear the piano part in your mind. And I find that initially they usually have trouble hearing it as a piano, that they want to hear it in their own voice.
Like, so you say when they're imagining the melody in their head, they're hearing themselves sing it in their head.
Right, they're hearing bum 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 ba, as opposed to a piano actually playing
right
the sound.
Right.
That becomes much more difficult for them when I say, okay, now I want you to hear the other voice in your mind. That if you've heard the top voice, you should be equally proficient at hearing the lower voice in your mind. If you've done that from the beginning, if you're at the stage where you know you have two voices going all the way through this invention and you know what they both sound like, when you get to that five-voice fugue, you're going to know what those sound like too. You're in the habit of learning the parts when you learn a piece of music. This is something you pick up from Bach. It's not something you pick up from Chopin or Beethoven. The skill is transferable, and it makes your Chopin and Beethoven sound much better.
Right.
But you learn it studying Bach.
So you're saying Bach's encouraging them to really hear the instrument and how it shapes these melodies and how it's going to play these melodies.
Well, and there are times when I might even encourage a student to hear a melody as a different instrument. I might say, this is trumpet-like, hear it as a trumpet. This is cello-like, hear it as a cello. The point is the level of control that they have over their imaginative abilities with the music.
Right. And Bach really helps bring that out, you're saying.
It does. Fourth category is learning to control articulation. As a beginner, there are really only two.
And define articulation for the general public here.
Sure. I'm talking about the length of time that the note you touch takes. That if I'm playing the F major invention and I play bum 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 ba da 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 dun 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 dun, I have two general articulations there. There are the eighth notes, which are short. And that's pretty much how we always did it. And then there are the 16th notes, which are legato. Da 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 da.
Right, so legato versus staccato, basically.
Legato versus staccato. And it's pretty much always those two rhythmic values you have in Bach, that the steady one, the eighth note, is short, and the faster one is legato. You learn as a pianist to feel those two articulations and to make them very easily in Bach because there are only two and you have to apply them the same way all the way through. You can make that more complex as you become more advanced, but the basic structure of it is always the same. You have these two general articulations.
Mm-hmm.
The last category, and this is perhaps the most important one, is separating the motion of the hands. That when we play the piano, what we're really learning is to make the right motion with our hands. One problem that a lot of pianists have is making the same motion with both hands all the time. And if you're playing a piece of Chopin and you're doing that, you can get away with that in the easier pieces and not notice it the same way that you will when you get to harder pieces and cannot play them. But even in a very easy piece of Bach, because the two hands are doing different things, you have to learn to cut that invisible ribbon between them. You have to learn to make a separate motion that is not connected at all. And that's a skill that transfers over to everything else that you play.
And Bach exposes the need for that.
Yes.
It's like, you know, patting your head and rubbing your belly for pianists, basically. Doing that throughout the entire piece. That's what Bach requires.
Yes. So just to briefly sum up those five categories. First, there are rhythmic principles established, both the counting out loud and the metronome. Second, there is learning to find melodies and bring them out. Third, there's hearing the different parts in your mind and being able to correctly bring them out as a result of hearing them. Fourth, there's learning to control articulation. Fifth, there's getting the motion that your hands make separate. All of these things are benefited by the progression that you go through. So you learn them at a very basic level when you're playing a Bach invention, and you find as you go through a sinfonia, through a French suite, through the well-tempered clavier, that these things have a snowball effect, and the development in your ability goes way up. Your sight reading becomes much better as a result of it. Your ability to hear harmony becomes much better as a result of it. And I mean, he wrote so much music that even though we had the same piano teacher, we played a lot of different pieces by Bach. I mean, there was a little bit of overlap, but I would say most of the Bach that we learned, especially on the advanced side, was not the same pieces. I mean, you're going through the same cycle in terms of study. the same progression in terms of learning, but there's so much music from Bach that even as a study tool, you can take different routes and still get to the same place.
Well, thanks so much for sharing. That's something I know was really helpful for our students to hear, and certainly you explained it very eloquently, and so I appreciate you coming on the show and explaining that for us.
Well, thank you.
You are listening to Music for Life. Today we are talking about music for education, exploring great music that was written primarily as a teaching tool, more than just for performance material. So much of the music we have access to today was written because composers needed music for their students to play. So this necessity was the mother of all these great musical inventions. We just heard how this was the case in the time of J.S. Bach, what we term the Baroque era. This was also the case in the next period of music history, the Classical era, with its famous composers Franz Joseph Haydn and Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Haydn wrote many of his 62 piano sonatas for his students. This one, being played here by Emil Gilels, is an example of one of those sonatas. Mozart wrote many of his pieces as teaching material for his students. One of his most famous pieces, particularly because of its lack of difficulty level, is the Sonata in C Major, Kirchhoff 545, played by many budding piano students. This has been nicknamed the Easy Sonata or Simple Sonata, and Mozart himself called it a Sonata for Beginners. Here is Sviatoslav Richter playing the first movement of this Sonata K545, by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
Thank you.
Sviatoslav Richter performed the first movement of Mozart's Sonata K545 in C major, nicknamed the Easy Sonata or Simple Sonata, or as Mozart called it, a Sonata for Beginners. We are exploring the vast array of music written as a teaching tool, composers writing pieces for their students to play. We've been hearing a lot of piano music because these composers were pianists and they taught piano. But here's a violin sonata written by Beethoven, a composer who came around in the latter part of the classical era. Now, a violin sonata is usually a piece written for violin and piano. And this particular piece was dedicated to one of Beethoven's piano students who played the piano part for the premiere of this work alongside a prominent violinist of the day. So here's a little bit of Violin Sonata No. 10 by Beethoven. This is a bit of the first movement with David Oistrakh playing the violin and Lev Oberin on the piano. So that's just the first section or the exposition of the first movement of Violin Sonata No. 10 by Beethoven, and that was a piece dedicated by Beethoven to one of his piano students who played the piano part at its premiere. This piano student was none other than Archduke Rudolf of Austria, to whom Beethoven dedicated 13 other of his compositions. One of those 13 compositions is Beethoven's Concerto for Violin, Cello, and Piano, a work that features this trio of soloists alongside an orchestra commonly called the Triple Concerto. Now, though there is no record of Archduke Rudolf performing this piece, Beethoven's biographer Anton Schindler says this is for whom Beethoven originally wrote this piano part. Here is the third and final movement of Beethoven's Concerto for Violin, Cello, and Piano, or a triple concerto, performed by the Eroica Trio with the Prague Chamber Orchestra. Thank you. You are listening to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today, our program is titled Music for Education, and we are exploring compositions that were intended to serve as a teaching tool. A healthy portion of the great composer's output included music written as material for their students to help shape them into better performers and musicians. That was a piece by Beethoven, reportedly written for one of his piano students and great patrons, Archduke Rudolf of Austria. It is a concerto featuring a trio of soloists, violin, cello, and piano, alongside an orchestra. That was the third movement of Beethoven's Triple Concerto, as it's commonly referred to, performed by the Eroica Trio with the Prague Chamber Orchestra. Moving into the Romantic era now, compositions were being put on display through public performances. At this time, a greater emphasis was being placed on virtuosity, the ability to impress the audience with amazing technical feats on an instrument. To provide scholastic educational value to the player and entertainment value for the audience, several Romantic composers wrote sets of pieces called etudes. As stated at the beginning of this program, these are studies, as the French word indicates. But more than just exercises for drilling certain skills in the privacy of a practice room, they were also written to be publicly performed and enjoyed by the listener. The most famous etudes are probably that of Frédéric Chopin, one of which we heard at the beginning of the program. Here's an example of Chopin's etude nicknamed the Octave Etude. The technical exercise for the pianist is having to play the entire piece in octaves, either in both hands or one hand. And octaves, for those of you not familiar with the piano, basically that's eight keys on the piano, the first note and the eighth note played simultaneously. And for your hand to do that, it has to stretch pretty far. Most grown pianists can stretch a little bit more than an octave, but not all can. But an octave is a pretty decent stretch. And so for an entire piece to utilize this harmonic interval, the octave, and to use it over and over and to do it very quickly is quite a technical feat. It's quite a study for the pianist. But it's not just octaves being drilled in like an exercise type of way, but it's constructed in a way where it sounds like a pleasing piece of music. So let's listen to Chopin's Octave Etude, performed by Murray Pariah. Thank you. That was Murray Pariah performing Chopin's Octave Étude. An étude is a piece of music intended to make the player better. And in the Romantic era, composers often wrote these études, these studies, as performable pieces of music, not just pieces to be drilled in the privacy of the practice room, but pieces that sounded to the audience like an enjoyable piece of music. And in the Romantic era, the audiences loved to see the virtuosity, to see the technical accomplishment of the performer. One of Chopin's most famous etudes is actually a slow etude. Now, when you think of etude or you think of study, like the one we just heard, you would think generally these would be faster pieces, but this slow piece has a lot of technical demands in the way the hands interact and the way the melody is treated within the hands. So certainly there are educational benefits to playing these slow etudes as well. This piece also has a faster middle section, which has its own set of awkward stretches that come very quickly and require that particular kind of study for the pianist. But this etude is largely a slow piece of music and probably one of Chopin's more famous melodies. Here's the etude, Opus 10, number 3 in E major, again performed by Murray Pariah. So that was Chopin's Etude in E major, Opus 10, number 3, performed by Murray Pariah. An etude is a study, and though many etudes are faster and very impressive pieces of music, this piece was mostly slow, and this slow piece of music provided its own set of technical challenges that the pianist would study. We're discussing today music for education, compositions that were written as a teaching tool, either the composer writing these pieces directly for one of his or her students, or a piece of music intended to perfect or educate the performer in a specific technical accomplishment, like an etude. When we come back, we'll talk more about the etudes of the Romantic era. We have a guitar etude coming up. And then we'll also talk about composers of the 20th century who had a great deal to do with educating their students through their compositions. We'll also have our Classroom Corner segment, which will feature a special essay written by a piano student about what her piano lessons have taught her about life. You won't want to miss that. So we'll be right back.